Okay, thank you very much, Neil, for the invitation and the introduction. So I'll tell you a bit about some of my somewhat less conventional research on searching for dark energy, in fact, off the beaten track in recent years. So in the first part, I'll cover what I call direct detection of dark energy on Earth. And in the second part, which is more cosmological, I'll turn to how can we learn about dark energy at both early and late times using consistency test of the Lambda CDM model. So just as a, just to clarify, when you see a person's face, if their name is in blue, it's a student. If it's in red, it's a postdoc, to give visibility to early career collaborators of mine. Okay, so if I want to bring you off the beaten track, I need to tell you first, what is the beaten track? Okay, so simplifying quite a bit, the beaten track in searching for dark energy is really about looking for gravitational signatures of dark energy. In other words, looking for the signatures of dark energy's energy density on standard cosmological probes, which either probe the background expansion, which is how we first discover dark energy, or the growth of structure. So you might say, okay, the growth of structure is technically not really at the background level. That's true. But the standard analysis we carry out nowadays on the growth of structure are really probing the effect of the modified expansion due to dark energy as it back reacts on how structure grows. Anyway, the gist of this is that lots of effort nowadays is going into trying to pin down the dark energy equation of state, which is very close to the value -1 predicted for the cosmological constant. Okay, so that's great. And we've learned a lot of things from the beaten track. And nonetheless, I think there are good reasons to move off from this. And that's going to be the focus of the first part of my talk, where I'll discuss direct detection of dark energy on Earth and in cosmological probes. So what do I mean by this? So the question, the key question here is, are gravitational signatures of dark energy the end of the story? And to see why this might not be the case, let's take a step back and look at dark matter instead. Okay, so we discovered dark matter in the 20s and again in the 70s through its gravitational interactions in clusters and galaxies. But nowadays, the state of the art in searching for dark matter is really about nailing down dark matter's non-gravitational interactions. And you can see this in this very schematic Feynman diagram, where you have interactions between normal matter and dark matter. And depending on how you read the diagram, you get different types of detection channels, which include direct detection, indirect detection, and collider production. Now I'm going to focus on direct detection, which is what you get if you read the Feynman diagram from bottom to top. So what you get as time goes on is dark matter scattering off visible matter. And you look for the products of this scattering in typically in large underground experiments, which are designed to minimize contamination from all sorts of backgrounds. So that's really the state of the art in how we search for dark matter experimentally today. So what about dark energy instead? Is there, like, can we construct a similar picture for dark energy? What are the limitations? So I was first inspired to think about this question from this paper, which from 12 years ago from Fergus Simpson, where he looked at what are the allowed cross-section, interaction cross-sections between various components of the universe at typical cosmological energies, like of order EV or less. And as you see, most of the interaction cross-sections are very tightly constrained, except for those between dark energy and other components, especially between dark energy and electrons. Now, this analysis is not totally correct. There's a bunch of factors which are off, but the takeaway message is that in principle, large interactions between dark energy and other components are allowed by cosmology. And so maybe we can hope to look for them either in cosmological observations or on Earth. Now there's an immediate obstacle, okay? So let's assume dark energy and visible matter, baryons, do indeed talk to each other. What's the first obstacle? Well, if dark energy is due to a new particle, this typically has to be very light. It has to be essentially held in place by Hubble friction. So you need a field which has mass below H naught today, so below 10 to the minus 33 eV. And if you don't do anything funny on the theory side, this will typically have gravitational strength coupling to matter. This is important. So unless you have a symmetry which protects couplings between dark energy and visible matter, even if you don't put these couplings by hand at tree level, they are going to be generated anyway at loop level. So you cannot avoid couplings between dark energy and visible matter. And this was first realized in the late 90s by Sean Carroll in this seminal paper. So the immediate consequence of these two points is that whenever you have a light scalar field, which is dark, playing the role of dark energy, you are bound to get unwanted fifth forces of this form, okay, long-range fifth forces. And this is a problem, of course, because we do not observe fifth forces, at least not in a local universe. So we need to hide this. We need to find a way to either remove this or hide it in a clever way. So let's take a closer look at this, the form of this fifth force. It's a very schematic Yukawa-type force, but it's useful just for the sake of argument. So you can see that looking at this fifth force, there are at least three knobs I can play around with if I want to try to hide the force. And the name of the game is really to hide the force in dense environments where we know that Einstein's gravity works very well. So one knob I can play with is the coupling. I can make the coupling scale very high, so the coupling can be very weak in dense environments. And that's what you get in symmetron-type screening models. Or I can play around with the inverse square power law, and this happens, for example, in the Weinstein case, in the Weinstein mechanism, simplifying a bit. Or I can play around with the range of the fifth force, which is essentially the inverse of the mass of the mediator, the effective mass of the mediator. So I can try to make this fifth force extremely short-ranged in dense environments. And I'm going to focus on this possibility here, which is what you get, for example, in screening mechanisms of the chameleon type. But the takeaway message here is that in any case, we need to find a way to screen unwanted fifth forces if we want to couple dark energy to visible matter, which I argue is inevitable, in fact, from the theory point of view. So I'm going to focus on this chameleon mechanism. So how does it work exactly? The way it works is that you have your dark energy scalar field no longer responds to a bare potential, but it really responds to an effective potential. The sum of the bare potential and the direct coupling between your scalar field and the local matter density. So why does this work? Well, you can see this here. You see, if I increase the local matter density, what happens is that this line here becomes steeper, okay? So the bottom of the effective potential is steeper, and therefore the effective mass of your screen scalar, which is essentially a frequency of oscillations around the minimum, becomes higher. And in fact, for most cases, you get an effective mass for your scalar field dark energy, which scales as some power of the local matter density. And therefore, the range of the fifth force scales like some inverse power of the density, which is good. So in other words, this is a way to get a fifth force which is very short-ranged on Earth and very long-ranged in space, where this is totally fine because we know that we don't know what dark energy is, so it may very well be due to something which leads to a new fifth force. So the name of the game, if one wants to do direct detection of dark energy, is to phrase the question carefully. Can we detect screened dark energy on Earth using existing experiments? And this is a question we ask in this recent paper from last year with Luca Vicinelli, Phil Brax, and Davis and Jeremy Sexton, which made got lots of media attention, including here in a Canadian newspaper.
Hi, I have a question.
Yes, please go ahead.
So is the theory under control?
In what sense?
Like, in what sense is the effective expansion around that minimum under control?
Why should it not be in principle?
Well, the problem is that usually in these models, The scale M is so low that the value of the field VEV is so high that it's not a controlled expansion in powers of phi over M. Basically, your theory is strongly coupled around that minimum. And I don't know the theory of chameleon fields that actually doesn't have this problem.
I see. Okay. Yes. This we haven't looked at. In principle, this scale can be quite high. Actually, it doesn't need to be very low. Of course, the problem, maybe the real question is, what's the value of the field itself?
Exactly. That's the point. Is your theory under control? What is the quartic? Can you do calculations around that minimum? In most reincarnation of chameleon theory that I know of, that's not satisfied.
Yeah, that's true. We haven't looked at this issue, of course, but yeah, what you say is of course a good concern. Yeah. I don't know how to answer actually. Are there any more questions?
May I ask how does it work? Like when you have density which decreases and then increases.
What do you mean? Like.
Initially, like the density is going down, and then like at some point, the density like re-increases, right? How does the field evolve like during this period?
Which period exactly are you referring to?
So like, the universe is homogeneous in the beginning, or somewhat homogeneous, and now like it has a lot of perturbations, right?
Yeah.
So when, for example, like star form and stuff like that happens, how does the field evolve like at that point?
Oh, I don't think this has been looked at actually. What I can think of is that this is perhaps not, if this is really dark energy, maybe it's not so important, at least for the
first.
But then,
like, why is phi in the minimum?
Sure, that's sure. It depends on whether you can minimize its effective potential. It's not always guaranteed, of course. That's something you have to check in a case by case basis. Depending on your physical situation. Yeah, with all these caveats in mind, the question then is, can we detect interactions between this field and visible matter on Earth? And so how could this work? So we need a production mechanism for this chameleon dark energy and a detection mechanism. So what we consider here is, for the production, we consider a coupling of this chameleon field to the photons. And in lowest order, you can get at least two couplings. You can get a coupling to F mu nu, which is this could emerge quite naturally, even if you don't put it by hand at tree level. And we include also this formal coupling, which couples the derivative of the field to the field strength tensor of photons. And what this does is essentially it allows for production of the scalar in regions of very strong magnetic fields. And one example is in the sun. Between the radiative zone and the convective zone, there's a strip with a very strong magnetic field of order 100 Tesla called the Tuckock line. So what happens is you can produce, you can convert photons into chameleons in here, and they can then travel to Earth. Now you need to detect them, of course. So you need some sort of coupling to visible matter. And we consider, again, some of the most general couplings you can write down at lowest order. This is, of course, not the most complete dictionary. So you can have a coupling. This is the usual chameleon coupling, in fact, a conformal coupling to the trace of the energy momentum tensor of whatever field you're coupling to. And this is simply the local matter density, in a sense. And then we consider, in addition, two other types of couplings, one where you couple the kinetic term of the chameleon to the trace of T, and this is called a kinetic conformal coupling. And you can also couple the chameleon disformally to the field strength tensor, to the energy momentum tensor of your fields, of your visible matter fields. And this is really, in a sense, it's a generalized chameleon mechanism. And now, at the end of the day, what happens is that you can get a process in terms of Feynman diagrams, which looks very similar to the photoelectric process. So you get an electron which absorbs a chameleon particle, and then is emitted at a higher energy. So what you can look for is the difference in energy which is absorbed due to the electron absorbing the chameleon here. Now, for those of you who have worked on axions, and there are definitely a few people in here. This looks, in fact, very similar, analogous to the axioelectric effect, where you have an axiom here instead of a chameleon particle. So we can go and look for essentially this recoil energy over here on Earth. And we can do it, for example, in direct detection experiments. And one example is the xenon one-ton experiment, which is based in Italy, in Gran Sasso. And the reason it's interesting is because in mid-2020, they saw an excess of events in the KV region at roughly 3.3 sigma significance. So that's what it looks like. The background is the gray curve, and the measurements are this black point. So you can see roughly 3 sigma excess by eye. So one of the most popular explanations for this excess were solar axions, so really axions produced in the sun. Now, the reason this explanation doesn't hold is that if you want solar axions to explain this signal, then you're going to run in trouble with stellar cooling constraints, because you're going to produce many, many more of these axions in stars which are denser than the sun. So you'll make them much more short-lived. And this is not what we observe. So if we consider solar chameleons instead, the fit we get to the data is given by the blue curve. It's not as good as with a solar axion, but you see this, you clearly improve the fit over the background in the region where there's this excess. Now, the nice thing about solar chameleons is that, unlike solar axions, they are safe against stellar cooling constraints precisely because of screening. So you can avoid production, or you can avoid these chameleons propagating out of much denser stars precisely due to screening. So of course, this is all not conclusive. This could very well be a fluke or be due to mismodeled background. But I think the takeaway message is that we can look for screen dark energy on Earth in an interesting energy range for upcoming experiments, because of course there's going to be upgrades to xenon. There's going to be other experiments which will be looking at a similar region in terms of recoil energy. So this is definitely something we can test in current and future data, and something to look forward to. I'll stop briefly here and see if there are any questions before moving forward. Okay, none. All right, so I'll move to a more cosmological point of view. So here I discuss detection of dark energy on Earth. And one can, of course, ask, okay, so let's say dark energy and visible matter talk to each other with a large cross-section, which is required to explain this signal. What are the implications for cosmology? So in other words, what can cosmology tell us about interactions between dark energy and visible matter? And that's a question we ask ourselves in a paper from early 2020. And so we ask ourselves, what's going to be the impact on linear cosmological observables of a scattering process between dark energy and visible matter? So the way we approach this is in a very, very phenomenological way. So we assume that dark energy and baryons can scatter elastically. So you can write down your modified Boltzmann equations for the baryon velocity divergence and the dark energy velocity divergence. And it looks something like this. So this is these terms are here because of conservation of energy momentum. So this so the strength of these effects is controlled by 1 plus the dark energy equation of state. And this makes perfectly sense, because if you have an equation of state of -1, so lambda, you cannot scatter because you have a component which is totally smooth. Okay, so we play the following game. So the strength of these effects depends on sigma. This is the cross-section for interaction between dark energy and baryons. So let's crank up this cross-section to some huge value, which maybe is unrealistic, but just to see what the effects are. So we saw that even if we crank this up to a really huge value, which is the Thomson cross-section, just the cross-section for interactions between photons and baryons, we see literally no visible effect on linear cosmological observables. So on the CMB, the only thing that changes is the late ISW effect. So it shows up on very large scales. But even for, you know, Barnes-scale cross-section, you get only 1% changes in the power spectrum in the temperature power spectrum, which is totally below the cosmic variance limit.
Sorry, a sunny cloud. I don't understand. Like, yeah, you're talking about like a really, really light particle scattering with electrons. Like, why would that be characterized by a simple cross section?
You mean with no velocity or energy dependence or anything?
Well, like a Bose enhancement, that type of thing.
Yeah, no, sure. We are, of course, this is a purely phenomenological implementation. We did not commit to anything fundamental. We weren't thinking about any fundamental scenario.
So what makes it like a dark energy?
What makes this field, you mean, like a dark
energy? Yeah, like what tells you like it's dark energy field?
We don't have any field in mind, actually. We're really working at the level of dark energy density contrast and velocity divergence. We did not at any point specify that this is due to a field, if it makes sense. This is really just modifying the Boltzmann equations phenomenologically. We haven't committed to any fundamental scenario here, if it makes sense.
So to follow up on that, can I ask, so dark energy has a sound speed parameter, I guess, here. Mm-hmm. What's assumed for that?
We assume one. But what we checked is that even if you move it away from one, the effect is not the effect is still very small. And here, in fact, is the dark energy sound speed CS square. That's assumed to be one, as you would get in the simplest models of quintessence. But again, we did not commit to any fundamental model.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. So this was as far as the CMB is concerned. If we go to the metapower spectrum, the effects are even smaller on linear scales at least. Okay, it's below the percent level. So the conclusion is that at the level of linear cosmological observations, in principle, even at this phenomenological level, a huge cross-section for interactions between dark energy and baryons is totally allowed. And this goes back to the picture I showed you at the start, which is here. These are cross-sections in units of barn. So for reference, the Thomson cross-section is 0.67 barn. So you can now start to understand where, like, why this number is not totally crazy in this from this point of view. Now, of course, this is what I showed you is only true at linear level. Okay, so you can only trust this result for the metapower spectrum, say down to K of roughly 10 to the minus 2 or so. But you know, we might expect things to get more interesting in the nonlinear regime. So if we go to larger K, larger wave numbers or smaller scales. But we cannot, of course, rely on this linear Boltzmann equations. The only way we can get some insight into the nonlinear regime is really by running n-body simulations. So this is what we did. This was a project led by my student Fulvio in the Max Planck Institute, which came out about 2 weeks ago. So what we did is we ran n-body simulations where we allowed the baryon component to interact with this type of interaction with a perfect fluid dark energy component with a certain equation of state. And then we go and extract some observables, which include, for example, the nonlinear power spectrum. And let me show you some of the key results. So let's focus on this right-hand side. So this is the actual power spectrum we extract from our simulation. So this is the nonlinear power spectrum. So you see on linear scales, if we focus on, say, the solid lines, where you have scattering between visible matter and a component with equation of state above minus one, so you see in the linear regime, you get a suppression of structure, which is consistent with what I showed you from the Boltzmann equations. But something very interesting happens in the nonlinear regime. At some point, you have a transition. Rather than having a suppression of structure, you have an enhancement. And so this is the way this comes about is because of the role of angular momentum in collapsing structures. So when you have an interaction of this type between dark energy and visible matter, in the linear regime, what this gives you is essentially, it gives you a friction, which makes it more difficult to form structure, which is why you have suppression of power on large scales. But in the nonlinear regime, once structures start collapsing, what this does is it helps losing angular momentum. Okay, so it aids the formation of structure, and that's why you get an enhancement of power. So this is what we see in the meta power spectrum, and this is what we see in the power spectrum of baryons alone. Of course, this is not directly observable, so we need to look at the meta power spectrum. Now, the interesting thing is the effects in the nonlinear regime are much larger than the linear effects by even up to one order of magnitude. So we can really, if in principle, we could reliably model these wave numbers over here, which is, of course, a huge challenge for future surveys, we could go after signatures of something like this, which could be a smoking gun of this type of interactions between dark energy and visible matter. Of course, let me just show you some snapshots from our simulation so you can really see this effect with your eyes. This is a lambda CDM simulation, a reference simulation. If I let visible matter scatter with a component which has equation of state above minus one, in the linear regime, you get a suppression of structure. And you can see this in this box over here. You can clearly see that these peaks are less clustered compared to lambda CDM. If I let it scatter with a component whose equation of state is below minus one, you get the opposite behavior, you get an enhancement of clustering. And you can, again, if you compare these two inlets, you can really see it by eye. I think Jesse has a question.
Yeah, just real quick. I was wondering if you could clarify a little bit about how baryons are modeled in the simulations. You're referring to them as n-body, but are they, do they have hydrodynamics, or are the baryons modeled as some additional fluid, or how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So so to first order, we only used, this is a gravity-only simulation. We did not include hydrodynamics for good reason, actually, because we expect in principle that, you know, if we have such a huge interaction cross-section between dark energy and baryons, we expect this to somewhat back-react on the usual feedback processes. So it's not clear if the usual implementation is something we can apply here. So to first order, we just wanted to understand what happens in gravity-only simulations. So we use gadget 3 to run this, if that also helps answer your question.
And does the dark energy then also respond, via these interactions to what the baryons are doing, or instead is the dark energy being treated as, as some unperturbed fluid?
Yeah, we treat it as a background, essentially, over which these baryons can scatter. Of course, one could, in principle, there should be some back reaction on the dark energy component, but we did not look at this. But there's actually good reason, because if you assume that the sound speed of dark energy is one, then you expect perturbations to be damped on sub-horizon scales, which is the key assumption we made here. Yeah.
Okay, I see. So in some sense, then these simulations are not quite conservative?
In a sense, no. Of course, they apply only if you want to really connect them to some fundamental model, then there are some limitations as to how you can make this connection. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yeah. And besides the power spectra, we looked at different observables. Like we actually looked at halos and so on. And one interesting observable in this sense is the baryon density profile in halos, which we find can be significantly altered by this scattering process. In principle, by up to one order of magnitude for a large enough cross-section. So we conclude that...
Sorry, I'm still confused. I guess I didn't understand the answer to your previous question. So you said you don't have any baryonic processes, but then you're showing baryon profile? How does that work?
No, we don't include feedback, okay? But what we can still look for structures made of dark matter and baryons, which we can identify as halos. Of course, this is probably not realistic because in these inner regions, you expect baryonic feedback to play an important role, okay? So you should see this just as a zero for order result, of course. But nothing forbids us from looking for structures of like halos, even if we don't include feedback.
So if you don't have feedback, do you have cooling or do you have shocks? Or, I mean, what baryonic processes do you include?
No, we don't include radiative processes, no. We treat baryons essentially as a collisionless set of particles. It's gravity only.
No, but I don't understand what you mean by baryons. So are there shocks that form in baryons or not? So because if it's gravity only, then there's not really baryons.
So we don't include, we only include adiabatic physics, if that answers your question. more clearly. We have not looked at shocks, no.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this terminology is a bit confusing to me. So when you said you just have included gravity, usually baryons, there's pressure, isotropic pressure for them. But then for dark matter, the pressure is anisotropic. So that's basically, I mean, the difference. So, do you treat baryons as a fluid or as just collisionless particles? Like
collisionless particles.
Collisionless particles. So then what's the difference between baryon and dark matter?
Well, baryons here are allowed to scatter with the dark energy. Dark matter is not.
I see.
They pose to each other only by gravity, dark matter and baryons.
So you have two type of collisionless particles. One Correct. Of them scatters off dark energy, the other doesn't.
Okay. Correct.
I see. Thanks.
Jesse still had a question.
Yeah, just as a follow-up there, would that mean that your results could equivalently be applied to asking, you know, what if dark energy could interact with some, like, fraction of dark matter particles?
Yes. One could, in principle, translate them in this way, absolutely, because baryons are collisionless, yes. In fact, you can see this as asking, what if dark energy scatters with 20% of the dark matter, given that's roughly the ratio between baryons and dark matter? More or less, yeah. Are there any more questions?
Sorry, the cross section that you have is 100 times the Thomson cross section, right?
In this previous snapshot, yes.
Okay, have you considered cosmology?
Meaning the early universe.
This is at the times of BBN. Densities were much higher than they were today.
Mm-hmm.
So, what happens? Do you have a concrete model of dark energy that actually does this?
We don't. Okay, we can write down a Lagrangian, which gives you this behavior in the low energy limit. So this might not be, of course, good enough for BBN, but you can write down a Lagrangian with essentially where you need to couple the derivative of your field to the velocity field of your baryons to get this type of scattering. But I don't think one should extrapolate it up to BBN, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but we know about BBN, right? So
yeah, absolutely.
Large cross-sections are problematic at BBN.
No, but sure, absolutely. This was just for illustrative purposes, just to show you, just to exaggerate this. We do not take this number seriously, of course. One should not go beyond.
Is there a reasonable number?
We argue that one should not go beyond the Thomson cross section, order one, the number of order one here.
Yeah, but that still may be too high, you understand, right?
Yeah, of course. It's absolutely, yes. We did not look at BBN, but that's something one could do, of course. We do not put any bounds on this. We just want to show if you take some value for sigma, that's what you would see in cosmology or astrophysics in this case. But this is really just to exaggerate the effects. It's not a number we should take seriously, of course.
Right. But for perhaps, more reasonable levels of the cross-section, should we just take the effect that you're showing and then just multiply by the ratios of the cross sections, so for sigma of like 0.01 of Thomson, would we just take your curve and then multiply by 10^-4?
No, in the linear regime, you can do that with an exception. If you go too much beyond the Thomson cross section, then for the CMB, at least you need to worry about strong couple. You go into the tight coupling limit at some point and you need to work out the perturbations again. That's also one reason for not going beyond the Thomson limit. So it's not obvious that you can simply rescale everything. For smaller cross sections, it works. Beyond the Thomson cross section, it's not obvious.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, so that was all for the first part of my talk. So with a lot of caveats, which people have kindly pointed out here, I think there is, in principle, lots of room for direct detection of dark energy, both on Earth, if you consider screen dark energy with some sensible screening mechanism, and potentially even using cosmological and astrophysical observations. And that's really the takeaway message from the first part. And in the final part of my talk, I'll take a more cosmological point of view and I'll ask the more general question about, can we learn something else about dark energy at both early and late times in a way which doesn't rely on the standard approaches? And where in particular can we learn something more about dark energy in principle? Well, perhaps from the Hubble tension, of course. So we all know, and I'll advocate for the use of consistency test of lambda CDM to learn about dark energy, again, both at early and late times. So the Hubble tension, of course, is something we all know and love, maybe some of us. And it's this huge mismatch between local measurements of the Hubble constant and measurements which, with a bit of an abuse of language, I could call early time measurements. And there's a huge literature of proposals for models which could solve or not the Hubble tension. I think we can all agree that no model really works and most of them don't really go to the heart of the problem. So I think when I see this problem, the first, I think it's useful to take a step back and try to look at this tension with a different set of eyes, with a different set of eyeglasses. And I think the key question one has to ask here is, why, despite the Hubble tension, which is in a sense just a minor glitch, why does lambda CDM still fit all the data so well? Like if you take away the local H-naught measurements, then it, the agreement between lambda CDM and data is really amazing. So do we really need any new physics? And if so, at what times and what type of new physics? And I think all of this motivates consistency test of lambda CDM. And to justify this, let me show you one concrete example. If we take the Hubble tension seriously and also take EO and supernovae data seriously, we see that in principle, the only way, the most straightforward way to solve the Hubble tension is really to move the Planck contours from here over to here, which is the only place where you can be consistent with the local measurement, the orange band, and this green band. Okay, so this requires lowering the sound horizon by about 7%. One way of doing this is to raise the expansion rate before recombination. And you can do it, for example, with early dark energy. Now, the thing which always strikes me as amazing is that you need a huge amount of early dark energy around matter radiation equality. You need about 12% of it. And we're doing precision cosmology. We're doing percent cosmology. So the question is, if there's so much new stuff around matter radiation equality, how come we haven't seen it in CMB data on its own? Like surely we should have seen this in Planck data if it really was there. Now, a caveat to this question is that it might be true prior to the latest ACT data release, but I'll not cover this here. I'll take a Planck-centric view of the problem. Okay, so the question is, why is there no clear sign of early time new physics in the CMB data? And this motivates, from my point of view, early time consistency test of lambda CDM. And in this paper I put out last year, I singled out the early ISW effect as an interesting way to perform a consistency test. So what's the early ISW effect, EISW? If you work in the usual line of sight approach, you can write down contributions to your temperature and anisotropy in the CMB as a integral of the, over the line of sight of different physical contributions like Sachs-Wolfe, Doppler, polarization. And I'm going to focus on this one, which is the ISW, integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. And this really comes from a time variation of your Newtonian potentials. And therefore it's important whenever your potentials are not constant. So whenever the universe is not matter dominated. So this can be important at early times when there is a significant fraction of radiation. And this is the early ISW effect. Or in late times when dark energy makes potentials decay. And so the simple observation here is that if I throw in lots of new physics at early times, like 12% dark, early dark energy, it's inevitably going to affect how your potentials grow or decay in this case. And therefore it's going to affect the early ISW signature. And we can therefore try to isolate this in the CMB data if it's even possible. So what I propose to do is the most stupid thing you can do, which is simply take the early ISW source term and then put an amplitude in front of it. All right, so you can do the most stupid thing you can think about, just put an amplitude in front of this. And this is very similar to what you do with A lens, for example, where you can rescale the Lansing contribution to the CMB power spectrum. And in this case, what you can do is rescale the amplitude of the early ISW effect. And then ask the question, within lambda CDM, is this number here consistent with one if I try to constrain it with data? And the answer is actually yes. If I take Planck data at face value, the amplitude of the early ISW effect is perfectly consistent with one, as you can see over here. Now, another relevant question, actually, which is perhaps more important, can be, if I allow this amplitude to vary, do any of my other parameter constraints shift in an important amount? And the answer is no. The largest shifts one sees are for the scalar spectral index, NS, and for the amount of baryons, which in any case don't move by more than 0.3 sigma. Okay, so this sets very important constraints on actually what early universe new physics can do, because whatever you do in the early universe, you must respect this constraint. You cannot alter the early ISW effect by too much. In fact, within 3%, you are totally constrained within the lambda CDM prediction. And let me show you one important worked example here. If I take, again, early dark energy, there's been some debate as to how much it really works. And really the crux of the problem is that if early dark energy appears to be in tension with weak Lansing and large field structure data. So essentially what it does is it worsens the sigma 8 tension, however you want to call it. Now, why is this the case? And why does early dark energy work in principle? Well, it works because you can in principle fit the CMB data equally well as lambda CDM. You see the residuals are like super tiny, at least in regions which are not, you know, hidden by cosmic variance. You can fit the CMB very well with a high Hubble constant, you see 72 versus 68. But this comes at a very important price, and the price is an increase in the dark matter density. So you need roughly 20% increase in the dark matter density if you want to preserve this fit. And this increase in the dark matter density is what puts early dark energy in trouble with dark scale structure data. So one can ask the question, why is this increase occurring? Like, why does early dark energy want more dark matter around? And the reason is precisely this early ISW effect. This increase in omega C is precisely to match the early ISW amplitude. So in fact, if I compare, if I don't plot the whole CMB power spectrum, but I only extract the early ISW source, if I compare lambda CDM, this left column, with an early dark energy model with the same value of the dark matter density, you see you clearly get an increase in the early ISW effect by up to almost 20%. And this is happening because early dark energy makes your potentials decay faster, and therefore you source more early ISW. On the other hand, if I raise the dark matter density, what happens is the excess early ISW is much, much lower, much closer to zero, and therefore consistent with data. Now, this is example is focused on early dark energy, but in fact, what I argue is that this conclusion is going to hold for many models which increase the expansion rate before recombination, okay? So it's going to be a problem for many early time proposals to solve the Hubble tension. And let me just show you the problem from the large scale structure point of view. If you take the best fit early dark energy model, it gives you an excess power. This is the meta power spectrum, and this purple line is the wave number of interest for, say, BOS data. It gives you excess of power at the 20 to 30% level, which is totally excluded by BOS data. Now, if you look at this excess, it looks surprisingly similar, but with opposite sign, to the signature of massive neutrinos on the meta power spectrum. So with my student Alex and George and Blake, what we thought was, okay, maybe if we threw in massive neutrinos in the mix, we can hope to bring this down to zero in the wave number range of interest. So maybe if you put together massive neutrinos and early dark energy, you can get around this problem. Unfortunately, this naively it seems to work if you have a neutrino mass, a rather large neutrino mass of 0.3 eV. It turns out if you actually do the analysis properly, like actually run an MCMC, it doesn't work. And for a bunch of reasons, among which the fact that you actually worsen, you increase S8 because you are introducing extra matter component must be neutrinos at late times. So you actually even worsen the SA tension. And in fact, at the level to a CMB, if you introduce neutrino masses, you need to compensate by lowering H naught. So this really goes in the wrong direction. And you end up also worsening the fit to BAO data. So there's a bunch of problems which are not obvious if you just focus on this plot. So the conclusion is that through any massive neutrinos with early dark energy does not solve these problems, which are ultimately really connected to the early ISW effect. So Neil, I'll just check how I'm doing on time. It's
Exactly.
Should we stop here? I mean, it's totally fine.
Oh no, I mean, like, so we're fine to continue.
Okay.
It was just you, I thought, who had the time constraint.
Yeah, okay, I can go on for, say, like 4 or 5 more minutes presenting the final part.
Oh yeah, perfect, perfect.
Okay, so this was the early side of this consistency test business. And let me just, now in the final part, present you one late-time consistency test of lambda CDM, which is based on the ages of very old astrophysical objects. And so that's historically, why were these old astrophysical objects interesting? Between the 60s and the late 90s, there were reports of objects which were older than the universe. Of course, what does one mean by older than the universe? Well, at the time people thought that the universe was an Einstein de Sitter universe with no dark energy and only matter. And of course, it turned out that the answer to this paradox was that simply the model for the universe was wrong. If you threw in dark energy, it's able to make the universe older at all redshifts, and therefore it can make it older than this very old objects. Okay, so historically, these old objects proved very important to set the stage for the discovery of dark energy. And this was something some people had actually anticipated before dark energy was actually discovered. So after 1998, they've sort of been forgotten. And so last year, at some point, I asked myself, can all the astrophysical objects do anything for cosmology nowadays in the 2020s? And the answer is potentially yes. And they could shed some light, in principle, on the Hubble tension, as we show in this paper with Fabio Pacucci and Avi Loeb. So what we did here is the following. Well, if you look at the age redshift relationship for a FRW universe, you see this depends on this particular integral, but the key point is that it goes like 1 over h naught, okay? So if I raise h naught, I make the universe younger at all redshifts equally younger. Now, of course, if I at the same time require that any object I see in the universe at any redshift is older than the universe itself at that given redshift, I can use this to set an upper limit on H naught. Okay. And the nice thing is that this integral here is essentially totally insensitive to early time cosmology, because it really only gets its contributions from Z below 10, let's say. Okay. So you can use this relationship to set to do a consistency test of lambda CDM. In other words, assume the lambda CDM expansion, and you can get some upper limit on H naught. If this upper limit, which is a cosmological upper limit, is in tension with the local limit, it could be the sign that something is needed either late times in beyond lambda CDM or in the local universe, or both, of course. And this conclusion will be totally independent of whatever you assume is happening in the early universe, whether it's early dark energy or something else. So what we did was we went through millions of galaxies. We went through catalogs of galaxies, which whose names you see here. And we looked in each redshift bin. We searched for the oldest objects we could find, okay? And we really plotted them. We plot the age redshift relationship of these oldest objects, which are about 100. And then we play the game. We try to get an upper limit on the Hubble constant in this way.
Wait, Sunny, can you just clarify about how these ages are determined?
Yes, absolutely. So we, of course, did not determine them. These were estimated from SED fitting, okay? So all these groups estimated the ages by a different, making different assumptions in their SED fitting. So they were up to 16 or 20 different methods. And we only chose First of all, ages for which there was a good redshift measurement and for which the age estimate was consistent across different methods.
Okay, so these methods involve making some population model for the stars.
Absolutely, information history and so on, absolutely. So the essentially what they did is some MCMC where the age is just one derived parameter, and we take this derived parameter for our analysis.
Is there some way just to sort of like roughly estimate what the possible systematic errors like size would be?
Yeah, I mean, you can sort of use, in a sense, you could estimate it via the spread between different methods, since you have many methods. And again, we only took those the objects whose ages agreed well across different methods as a zeroth order test for systematics. Of course, you are never protected against unknown unknowns.
Right.
That's always a concern, of course.
Right. Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah, so we got an upper limit, which is very interesting, which is age not less than 73.2. And so if we take this at face value, what does it imply? Well, it could imply that, okay, if the ages are reliable, of course, which is a huge caveat, one explanation could be that lambda CDM is not the end of the story, that we need some new physics at late times. Of course, this cannot be the dominant new physics for the Hubble tension. Most of it still has to come from early times. Or it could also be that lambda CDM is totally fine at late times, but we need something new in the local universe, which brings the local H naught down. Or it could just be a fluke or systematic. But thinking more in broad terms, the broad takeaway message is that maybe this is really a sign that early universe new physics alone is really not enough to solve the Hubble tension. As I also argued based on the earlier SW effect. So maybe we really need a combination of new physics at early times, at late times, and perhaps also in the local universe. So maybe the Hubble tension is best phrased as a mismatch between cosmological and local measurements, not so much as early versus late times. And in fact, I'm not alone in these conclusions. There have been many works in the past year, including this is by Katie Mack, who I saw in the audience, and other important works. We also argue that maybe the way we are phrasing the Hubble tension as early versus late time cosmological tension is maybe not the right way of looking at this. So I've finally come to my conclusions. I'll just leave you with two key plots and messages. In the first part, I hope I've convinced you that there's lots of potential for doing direct detection of dark energy on cosmological and terrestrial scales. And on the cosmological side, there's a lot we can learn about dark energy, both at early and late times, using consistently tests of the lambda CDM model. And all of this seems to point to the fact that if we really want to solve the Hubble tension, we need something more than just this simple picture with just early universe new physics, which is very tightly constrained from the early ISW effect. And in any case, there's a lot we can learn about dark energy, just going beyond standard searches for its gravitational interactions. And that's really the main takeaway message of this talk. So I'll stop here and I'm happy to take questions for the next 5-7 minutes or so.
Okay, great. Thanks, Sunny. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his great talk. Okay, are there any final questions for our speaker?
I think there was a question from Jesse at some point before.
Yeah. So go ahead, Jesse.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a minor thing, but when you were talking about the early dark energy constraints, you made the comment that when you vary both your early dark energy parameters and neutrino mass, the allowed values of SA actually go up. Mm-hmm. And that was counterintuitive to me because in my experience, mostly looking at like lambda CDM with fixed neutrino mass versus varying, like given a Planck constraint on AS, I would have expected that, you know, if more of your matter is in neutrinos, you suppress structure formation. So generally freeing neutrino mass, I would expect to like, you know, widen the Planck constraints on sigma 8, but in the downward direction rather than upward.
Yeah.
So and I'm wondering, this might just be a like, are we varying neutrino mass while also sampling like omega CDM versus omega matter? And that might be all it is, or is there some interesting degeneracy that with the early dark energy parameters? So
yeah, absolutely.
Somewhat technical, boring question, but.
No, that's a very good question. So first of all, this is S8. So sigma 8 does go down, but S8 goes up because S8 is the combination of sigma 8 and square root of omega m. So even though sigma 8 goes down, omega m goes up because you are throwing more matter. Okay, so neutrinos are matter at late times. So you are throwing more matter on top of the extra CDM, and that's what makes S8 actually worse. In terms of what we're varying the usual six parameters. So omega CDM instead of omega m. And so that maybe answers your question as to what we're varying at the same time as mu.
Yeah, I think the sigma 8, S8 distinction, it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Kareem, why don't you ask your question?
I have a question about what is dark energy detector name which detects dark energy in Shamirian graph? What is the detector name? And its detector diagram, what is this detector consist of?
Okay, so I'm not sure I caught your question, but there was a question about what the detector is and what does the Feynman diagram mean? So the Feynman diagram, I mean, you can simply write this interaction term in this schematic way. So you really have, what you have is a vertex between whatever field whose energy momentum tensor are coupling to and the chameleon field, okay? So of course, the fact that you couple, for example, to the energy momentum tensor here means that the strength of this vertex depends not only on these couplings, but also on the momentum of your chameleon. So in terms of what the detector is, this is a big tank of liquid xenon, which is placed underground under like 3 kilometers of rock to minimize contamination from cosmic rays and other radioactive backgrounds. So you can really look for these very tiny recoils in the KV range, in fact. And you typically use it to look for dark matter recoils over visible matter. So what you look for is essentially you have some visible matter which seems to recoil out of nothing, okay? But it could be due to dark matter if you have your whole background under control, if that makes sense.
So maybe just to save Sunny's childcare responsibilities, why don't we stop here? Thanks again, Sunny, for your fantastic talk.
Yeah, thanks everybody for the questions and participation. It was really good.